All right, welcome into the Dave Plyer Show with our radio special, Totally the 80s. In some respects, the pop culture of the 1980s reflected the era's political conservatism. For many people, the symbol of the decade was a yuppie, a baby boomer with a college education, a well-paying job, and expensive taste. The decade began in the shadow of the Iran hostage crisis and ended with the symbolic fall of communism. America found a two-term president in Ronald Reagan, a man who changed American economic policy and challenged the Soviet Union to help topple the Berlin Wall. The Exxon Valdez oil spill and the Chernobyl nuclear disaster revealed the impact of man on the environment. The first woman was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. We watched the Challenger combust live on television. John Lennon was killed. The Cubs clinched the National East title with Harry Carey calling the game. Jane Byrne and Harold Washington led our city. The AIDS epidemic was at the forefront. And JR was shot. At the movies, the 1980s was the age of the blockbuster. Movies like Return of the Jedi, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Beverly Hills Cop, all appealed to moviegoers of all ages and made hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office. We were scared from our seats watching the original Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, The Shining, Poltergeist, Creepshow, and Fright Night. The 1980s was also the heyday of the teen movie. Films like The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Risky Business, Revenge of the Nerds, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, and Valley Girl. At home and on the small screen, we watched The Cosby Show, The Wonder Years, Family Ties, Roseanne, Married with Children, Cheers, Newhart, Full House, The Golden Girls, and MASH broke rating records and still holds them with their finale to this day. We also rented movies to watch on our new VCRs, and by the end of the 80s, 60% of American television owners got cable. We watched MTV featuring artists like Madonna, Devo, U2, Billy Idol, Rick Springfield, Pat Benatar, Blondie, Joan Jett, Bon Jovi, and Bryan Adams. And heavy metal acts such as Metallica and Guns N' Roses hit the scene. It was the decade of big hair, big phones, pastel suits, Cabbage Patch Kids, Rubik's Cubes, Air Jordans, the Commodore 64 shoulder pads, and Pac-Man. But more importantly, it was an era of iconic moments that changed the world. Tonight we celebrate the decade with John Stamos from Full House, musician Bryan Adams, Tony Danza from Taxi and Who's the Boss, Anthony Michael Hall from cult films Vacation and Breakfast Club, Leah Thompson from blockbuster Back to the Future, Fred Savage from The Wonder Years, and George Wendt, Norm of Cheers. After the break, we'll kick things off with John Stamos right here on 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer, WGN.
We kick off our radio special, Totally the 80s, with actor John Stamos. With a career spanning more than 30 years, John has become one of the most revered television stars of his generation. Not long ago, John wrapped up Fuller House, a multi-camera comedy spinoff of iconic 80s and 90s comedy Full House, whereas John served as producer and guest star. He started his career in the 80s on General Hospital and also starred on the TV drama ER. He's been on Broadway and is also a gifted drummer, singer, and musician who occasionally tours with the legendary band The Beach Boys, of which he's been a part of for over 30 years. John currently stars as Dr. Nikki in the Netflix psychological thriller You, and I asked John what it was like to return to the original cast of Full House and on the set of the sequel.
Hey, hey, look alive! Uncle Jesse's here!
Hey, Uncle Jesse!
All right, hello! DJ, how you doing? That tooth come in yet?
Nah.
It's okay, one less to brush.
Well, I think that just the love of the show, I mean, we never imagined it. I never thought I'd still be talking about it. And I think over the... Like, I think like every 3 or 4 years, a new Full House fan is born. So it seems like there's a whole, you know, generation after generation gets turned on by that show through reruns. And so everybody was clamoring for more. But we all looked good, and everybody wanted to do some more of it. And Jeff Franklin and I had an idea to do a spinoff. We've taken our time to wait for the right place to do it. Obviously, Netflix is
just a
happening place.
I was going to say, you know, if you grew up in the 60s, you probably grew up watching like shows like The Brady Bunch, 70s, maybe Happy Days, 80s, Family Ties, The Cosby Show, and 90s, it was Full House. So I'm sure when you see these fans that are now, you know, in their 30s or whatever that might be, you know, it's wild. You're really part of American television history when you have a show like that appeals to everyone in the family.
Yeah, it's weird. I haven't. What's strange is just little kids come, you know, 4 or 5 year old kids, Uncle Jesse. Like, what? You know, that's a trip. But you know, it's for years. I think I didn't dislike it, but I just was trying to do other things in my career. And now, you know, that I got to do a lot of other stuff, it's fun to kind of bring it back, like an old friend or something. You know?
Was it pretty surreal being on the set and getting back together with everybody? Like you never thought that was going to happen again?
Well, we're together a lot. That part wasn't weird. But being on the set was weird because it's pretty exact. In fact, yesterday it really hit me. I was like, this is what's happening here, you know? But and they built the, Warner Brothers finally built the exterior of the house, of the full house, like that painted lady that's in San Francisco. They built that on the back lot of Warner Brothers, and I saw it yesterday for the first time. Walked around there, and this is weird.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Because it was a real house, obviously. It was actually a very popular, like, tourist destination
for
a
while. Yeah, it's still there, I guess. Yeah. I mean, the whole, you know, nostalgia seems to be really, you know, in vogue now. And I remember, like I loved Grease, for instance, you know, and I saw Travolta and Olivia Newton-John get together and, you know, sing something a few years ago. And I loved it, you know. So maybe I guess that's what we're doing for people that like Full House.
Harkening back to a simpler time, people's childhood and so forth, yeah. Now, I know you also do some awesome work for a nonprofit called Project Cuddle. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? That's some cool stuff.
Yeah, it's an organization that tends to abandon babies. You know, I mean, first of all, we try to educate to not abandon your baby and come to us if that's what you're thinking about. Also, we do a lot of... We find girls that just need help with prenatal care and guidance. But I've been working with that organization for a long time. We're up to about 800 or 900 babies saved. And,
wow.
Continuing on with that.
Well, that's very cool. So there are three things, John, people may or may not know about you. You play and tour with the Beach Boys.
It's still remains the highlight of my life. I just, for whatever reason, it's just, it's the you know, one of the greatest rock and roll bands in history. And then there's just a magical feeling about it. You just get up on stage and play music that you love, and people just love that music. You know, talk about nostalgia and going back to happy places when they hear that music. People just light up, and that's great to be, you know, to witness it every night with them. It's just, like I said, just every time I do it still, it's just, I can't, you know, I'm just elated with joy. It's overwhelmed with joy.
Well, and you've been playing the drums, and people might not know this, since you were like 8 or 9 years old. So, I mean, this isn't something new, really, from a talent perspective. You've always done this. It's just hooking up with the Beach Boys has been, you know, obviously a lifelong dream. And you're right, everybody knows this music, and when they see you on stage, it's just got to be ultra cool, you know?
Yeah, well, I hope so. Cool for me.
Well, I know you played with Willie Nelson, you played with Bruce Springsteen, John Fogerty. So, I mean, you get to make the rounds a little bit in a whole other world.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But, look, if I wasn't an actor, I wouldn't play with all those people. I mean, you know, I'm a decent drummer, but I'm not that good. You know, I mean, a lot of it comes from being famous. But, you know, I'll take it. I mean, that's what it takes.
Yeah. Now, the second thing I was going to mention that I found interesting, and it was at Graceland, I don't know, about a year ago, or maybe it was less than that, and you're the narrator on the Elvis Presley tour.
Yeah, right.
What got you involved in that?
Well, they asked me to do it, and I think they were going to have a bunch of different actors or musicians or whatever do it, and then I came in and did it. I said, no, yours is good enough. We'll just use yours. I remember... I had just come back from India, and I was really jet-lagged, and I had to go in and do that for a few days, and I was just trying to do my best. No, welcome to Graceland. This is John, you know, trying to do my best to announce your voice. But it was pretty cool. I got to take my family there last Christmas, and it was really sort of exciting to walk through there and hear my voice.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're kind of weaving yourself with all these classic, I mean, Elvis, the Beach Boys. I mean, that's, again, some pretty amazing things. And now the third thing people might not know, and we have this in common, is you were friends with the late legendary Don Rickles.
Yeah. He's, kind of going along that line of what you were just saying, I do love, you know, old school nostalgic stuff. There's so much to learn from, you know, these veterans that, I just try to, over the years, I've tried to align myself with them as friends to learn and hang out. And yeah, Don's certainly one of them. I did a show with Jack Klugman years ago called You Again, and I think that's when my love of the, you know, the cla- classic old guys came around. I hung out with Jack a lot, and you know, the Gary Marshall's one of my best buddies, and of course, you know, like I said, Rickles. Yeah, there's just a lot to learn from these guys. We had him on our show. I had him come down and do the pilot. We were trying to find a, I think it was written for an athlete, and a guy was going to do it, and he fell out a few days before. So I called Don, and Christina Milian was friends with Lil Wayne, and someone called Deion Sanders. And I thought, well, that's a funny tree shot.
I saw that.
And talk about, yeah, no filter. I was a Don. It was very funny, but he was, you know, I was on my toes that day. I was very nervous for what, you know. First of all, I just want him to be happy and have fun, which I think he did. And yeah. After we got him some vodka.
And he likes the vodka. That's right.
He likes the vodka. And then he was real sweet to those guys. But a couple of times, you know, he said something to Lil Wayne about, you know, don't worry, I talked to the warden. You're working the yard today.
That's classic. How could you not love that?
About a year before Don passed, he appeared with you on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and I love Jimmy, and he has a similar respect for the old school. And I want to share a little clip of you and Don with Jimmy back in 2016.
By the way, I love that you're here together, and thank you for coming together, because I love that you're such close friends, and you have this very, very close relationship. For how long? How long have you known John?
About an hour.
We've been friends about 30 years, I think.
Yeah. We met in a restaurant, right? You were sitting next to me. Tell them how we met.
Well, we were at, we saw you.
Don't touch me, though.
All right. This is the friendship right there. But before we start, can I just say, he's the highlight of my life. I love this man so much. And I'm so grateful to be on the show with him. I always thought, like, if I was ever to write a book, it'd be like, if you would have told me that one day I'd be on Jimmy Kimmel show with Don Rickles, I'd be like, wow. I'd be like, well, Jimmy Kimmel won't.
Yeah,
how can he have a show? But the Don Rickles,
Rickles part. See, you're rubbing off on him. He's now insulting me, thanks to you.
Shut up.
The best story was I got to take my parents to see him and Mr. Sinatra.
Oh, I think I have pictures
of
this.
In the 90s, yeah. And
yes.
I was dating Paula Abdul at the time.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Paula Abdul, right, Don?
Of course. Yeah, that was the first girl you were in heat for.
And the beauty was that
how many girls have you seen him with, Don, over the years?
Come on,
well, he's been with all sorts. The ones I used to bother with had the beach ball and they were 12. Well, he's a good-looking kid, and he was always, I call him a kid, he's a man today. But yeah. They always used to come, him and Bob Saget,
yeah.
Who's our dear friend, and you know,
yeah,
Bob,
sure.
He's a great guy.
Of course.
Bob's not here tonight, his guitar broke. You gotta watch Bob Zach. Coming home tomorrow. And my mother bang, boom, boom. And it's all clean stuff that your eyes fog up. Anyway,
Well, Full House was an iconic sitcom of the 80s and 90s, and these days you can see John Stamos' Dr. Nikki in the Netflix psychological thriller You. And you can also catch him on the road with the Beach Boys. John, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, man. Really nice talking to you, Dave.
Well, thank you for hanging out with us, John. All right, stick around, folks. There's much more ahead on 720 WGN. Rock icon Bryan Adams has been performing for over 40 years, helping to make him one of the world's most enduring and successful artists, with worldwide sales of more than 65 million albums. The Grammy Award-winning artist who issued his platinum-selling Reckless featured hit records Summer of 69, Heaven, Run to You, Somebody, and it all defined the 80s and beyond. And he's joining us tonight. Hey, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I wanted to step back a little bit and talk about how you got into music to begin with. You know, I know music became a big part of your life at a pretty early age, like 13, 14 years old. How did you get interested in guitars and performing and singing?
I just, when I was very young, I just wanted to play guitar. Or actually, I really wanted to be a drummer. And my parents bought me a guitar instead. And I just picked it up and started, you know, learning how to play it. I never took any lessons, and I just would listen to my records and work it out. I had a book of chords, and I just learned how to put my fingers on the guitar, and that's how I learned how to play.
So
from there, it was just about mimicking and getting as close to it as I could. And then from there, just starting with bands and just playing in the basement with bands and getting other musicians that were interested as well. And it just went from one thing to the next. And for me, as a youngster, I became quite interested in not being in school.
Uh-huh.
So I just went out and joined a band and went on tour. And that was age 15. I never looked back.
you know, I love the story. You told us before that you were going to sing and play the guitar until the band found a singer, but they never found one. So you were the singer.
That's right. And I can remember one time particularly when I was with everybody in my basement, and actually it was my friend's basement, and they said, okay, well, let's do a recording. And we were recording a song. It was a Blind Faith song called Can't Find My Way Home. And who's going to sing it? And everyone went really quiet. And I said, well, I'll have a go, you know. And then I remember singing the song, and it wasn't like multi-track recording. This was like a two-track recording. And at the end of the recording, I looked around the room, and no one was saying anything. Everyone sort of looking at me. And I said, what? It's like, oh, nothing. Listen to that back, you know. And I think it was, they just had never heard my voice before. They didn't know I could sing.
Did you know you could sing at that time? I mean, did you have the confidence to do that yourself?
I don't know if I had any confidence. I just had this sort of fearlessness about it. Because I used to sing to myself when I went to school. And I would sing, you know, as I was walking to school. And so that's sort of where I started. Just, you know, like I said, listening to records and singing along with those. And just, you know, just kind of mimicking it as opposed to sort of just being trained.
Yeah.
And I was never trained.
That's untrainable. But that's a natural, yeah. But that's natural talent right there, which is something to be said for that. Now, I know real quick, in like 1978, you signed with A&M Records. You were 19 at the time. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was 18, but I had come to the point where I'd been working with Jim Vallance writing songs, and he was a busy guy, and I was just a young nothing. I used to actually had borrowed money off him to get to his place because I had nothing. And bus fare.
It's so, okay. You know, it's how you start, right?
I got a deal, and I managed to get a deal based on the demos that we had. We'd made some recordings in his basement, and based on those recordings, I managed to, you know, to scramble a sort of record contract together. I mean, it was a terrible deal, but it was a foot in, and it was an opportunity to prove myself. And I always had this feeling like, okay, well, even if I sign this terrible contract, at least if things go well, we'll be able to change it later. I'm still signed to that deal today.
Well, I was going to say, though, you know, when you're 18 years old, trying to get your name out there and put yourself on the map, you do those things, though. And, you know, and once you find that success, you're kind of paying it forward to yourself a little bit, that once you find that success, then, you know, the better contracts and so forth will come your way. But that's the only way to really kick yourself off and get started, is getting your foot in the door.
I don't know how I had the balls to do that, but that's how I started.
Yeah, and I know there was a couple of songs, you know, recorded early on that became part of your first album, and I also know you recorded a disco hit. It was Let Me Take You Dancing that right. You did at that time. Is that something, did you do that because that was kind of what was happening right now in the music scene, or was your heart always with rock and roll?
We had made a bunch of demos. That record actually was made for us, you know. We my demo actually is a lot slower than that, so it was sent to a DJ in New York, and he sped it up, and that's you know, that's how that record, but that's, you know, really, that's a long time ago.
Now, your first album came out in 80, You Want It, You Got It came out soon after in 81, then came Cuts Like a Knife, which included, you know, the hit Straight from the Heart. Would you say that album put you on the map? I mean, Reckless really just threw you out there, but was Cuts Like a Knife the one that really made you a household name?
I look at You Want It, You Got It, which was the second album, Cuts Like a Knife, which was the third album, and Reckless, the fourth album. It's kind of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
They were the records that I made with Bob Clearmountain and Jim Vallance, and it was kind of like being on a little bit of a treadmill. I'd write and record and go on tour, and then write and record and go on tour, and then write and record and go on tour. And it was like Groundhog Day, and we just kept doing it. And as the tours continued, and as the concerts, you know, we were getting better and better reception, I kind of felt as though there was kind of a groundswell starting that, you know, even from the early days of opening up for bands like Foreigner and the Kinks.
Sure.
Those early days were formative in being able to just be able to know what direction I was going to go. And so when I would come back from tour, I would say, you know, I think I need a song like this, or I need to do a song like that, or I had these little ideas, and I would sort of put the puzzle together in the studio with Jim, and then go and record it with Greyhound. And all those records were recorded in New York and in Vancouver, and they have a similar sound to them, and there's just something about, when I look back on those albums, that trilogy of records is, you know, that was the thing that, those were sort of my groundbreaking, you know, cornerstone records.
And but also at that time, it was MTV too. I mean, that was the other thing, you know, MTV was just hitting, hitting homes, and, you know, to be a part of that in the beginning had to propel things as well.
I'm not sure how much MTV was accessible to everybody in the very, very early days, because not everybody had cable television. Mm-hmm. And so in the very, very early days, it was exciting because it was all starting to happen. More people were getting hooked into this thing, and there was, there seemed to be a propulsion of music television as well. You know, from there it went to VH1. There was all kinds of stuff that was going on, and people were hooking into it because there wasn't an alternative like there is today, where you can just go on the internet. You know, if anybody wanted to hear a record, you had to go on and listen to your radio station. So to suddenly have a visual connection other than television, because television was never going to play, you know, rock videos. There was no future.
No form for it, yeah.
So, you know, for the kids to find out that there was an avenue out there that was exciting and young and was speaking to them, you know, everybody went to it, and it became popular because it was the only avenue that gave people an alternative from television and radio.
Well, we're talking to Grammy Award-winning rock musician Bryan Adams, and there's much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Now, Run to You was released as a single from Reckless, and then you got the legendary Tina Turner to sing with you on It's Only Love. Did you always have Tina in mind for the song?
Tina was being produced by a guy called Carter, and Carter and I had made some records together for a band called Prism, and Jim and I had written the songs for them. And so Carter wrote to me and said, hey, will you write me a song for Tina Turner? And I was in the middle of making Reckless, and I was like, wow, I'd absolutely love to do that. I have a song that might be really great. Would she be interested in singing on my record? And didn't hear back. And then, coincidentally, just before we were mixing the record, I heard that she was coming through town. She was the support act for Lionel Richie. And she was playing in Vancouver at the time. And so I sent a copy of the song to her manager and got a call back and said, listen, Tina would like to meet you. I said, wow. So I went down to the gig, and she's finished playing, and I just remember this mane of hair coming down the hallway, and I could hear her going, where is he? Where is he? And I was stood there by the door, and she said, there he is. And she goes, Bryan, I love this song, you know. And so and I said, great, can you come and record it tomorrow? And she said, I can't. And so we recorded it, and it was one of those moments in the studio where I recorded the song for myself in my register, and hadn't really thought about it being a duet. I mean, it was one of the things we had to try. So when we first started it, she was trying to sing at my register, and it wasn't working. So I went out there and just sort of sang with her and just said, you know, just go for me, sing it up here. And I started singing at her, and then she started singing back to me. And that was it. It was just a lot of fire. And by the time she left the studio, I remember going back in, and it was like, you know, that moment where like there's been like a huge gust of wind is open.
Yeah, what I think is pretty surreal. Yeah, exactly.
You know, like a gust of wind is open, blown open the front door, and it's just like, and you don't know what's hit you. And then you go back and you close the door and you look around the room like, okay, what fell over? And it was kind of like that moment. And I said, I really hope you ever got that on tape.
And yeah, me too. I'm sure.
I got it. And we played it back and it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, she truly elevated that song. Had it not had her performance on it, I really don't think that song would have had much of a life, because it was... To me, it was powerful. It's so needed to have the connection of two people on it, and so my utmost respect and gratitude to her for making that song come alive, because she really did.
I bet. You know, I've heard you talk about this before. I have to bring this up. Most people believe that the summer of 69, which is such a summer anthem, still to this day, to listen to. It wasn't really about the year. It's not about the summer of 1969. Tell us what your interpretation is of this song.
Well, the song is it's really about you know, it's a song about regret and loss of innocence, and it's a broken promise of youth. But it's also about finding out about what love is, and it's about the 69 reference is very much about, you know,
sex.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was never about a particular year, because it was about looking back on moments in my life, or you know, moment back in anyone's life on a summer where you discovered yourself.
Sure.
And you discovered what it was like to be in a sexual relationship.
Yeah, it's an interesting way how you put that. It's a recognition of a life change and a loss of innocence. That's a really great way of putting that.
Yeah, and it's about discovering also. You're losing one thing, but you're gaining something else. You're learning about yourself, and it's about you know, looking back on good times and discovering sex.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I'm sure that's why that song is memorable to a lot of people, especially those who grew up that year and heard that song, that there was probably a connection for them as well. How cool is that, rediscovering all from 30 years ago? And I love the fact that...
It was frustrating, wasn't it?
But I mean, you wrote these songs at the same time, so they have the same feel, probably the same tone of when you wrote that album. But it kind of must have been somewhat of a treasure hunt, though, finding all these great things.
Yeah, it was really fun, and then trying to find the photographs, which I went back and I found as many of the photographers as I could, you know, because a lot of the photographs were unregistered. I didn't know who they'd taken them, so. And some of them I did, and so the guys that I did know, I would approach them and ask them to help me put things together, which they were very kind and did. And then in putting the package together, it was really exciting.
Hello.
All those old songs. In fact, one of the songs on the record is called Reckless, and it was written at the very last minute when I decided I was going to call the album Reckless. I thought, well, let's write a song called Reckless. And so we wrote this song, but because of time constrictions, we didn't put it on the record. We didn't re-record it. However, I should have just put the demo out, because the demo is, you know, if you've got the repackaged version there, you should listen to it, because that song should have been on the album. It's one of the only regrets I have on the record.
Musician Brian Adams. Our radio special, Totally the 80s, continues right after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. Formed in 1967, signed in 1971, and fronted by iconic vocalist Kevin Cronin since 1972, REO Speedwagon is a band where the main constant over the decades is a never-ending desire to give their all to their fans, year in and year out. Kevin was born in Oak Lawn, but the band hails from Peoria. And to talk about it all, Kevin Cronin joins us. Kev, it's been almost 50 years. How did this journey begin?
Well, it was, the Chicago Sun-Times at that time had a musical want-ad section and classified section, but it cost $15 for each want-ad, and I was looking for a guitar player and a bass player. So they wanted to charge me $30. I couldn't take out one ad for two musicians. And mm-hmm. I was like, I don't have $30. So I got the idea to start this kind of musicians referral service, like you say. And I was getting calls from, you know, and everybody who called was like, oh, we have the greatest band in the world. We're looking for a bass player. And you know, after about a month of this, I'm like, what have I've created a monster. This is ridiculous. Anybody could tell me anything, right? So I get this call. The guy's telling me, oh, yeah, we have a recording contract with Epic Records.
Right.
You'll get a $200. The guy will get a $200 a week salary. And at the time, I was driving a yellow cab in Chicago, you know,
wow.
Which I kind of dug. It was kind of fun.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, but I'm like, so what's the name of this band? And he's like, well, I can't really tell you that because, you know, we're on tour right now. And I'm like, yeah, right, you know. And finally, I'm like, you know, I don't think I can help you. And he goes, all right, well, the name of the band is REO Speedwagon. And I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, wait, I've heard of those guys. They play the Dex Card Wild Goose Circuit, you know. And I'm like, you know what? I've got a guy in my vast library of lead singers.
Yeah.
I've got this one guy. He sings, he plays guitar, he writes songs.
He's perfect.
Yeah, you know, it was Gary Richrath on the line. Gary's like, yeah, I want to meet this guy. Well, of course, you know, I'd given myself a stellar review.
That's awesome.
Literally, that's how I got the gig.
You know, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it was a scam, basically. I kind of scammed my way into the group, and I've kept up the masquerade for 45 years.
What exactly is an REO Speedwagon? That was a truck company, like a motor company in the early 20th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. The REO Speedwagon was a flatbed truck that it was actually originally a fire truck that could, you know, get to the fire quicker than a horse-drawn buggy, and it was kind of prophetic in a way because they were you know built to last, you know, they were mm-hmm. They kind of looked cool, you know, so the name kind of stuck with us. So
yeah, perfect.
Here we are, man. Yeah.
There you
and,
are.
You know, matter of fact, the logo, you know, the famous wing logo
yeah.
that's on all of our T-shirts and everything, that was basically the hood ornament from the original Aria. And can you imagine now? They gave us, you know, they signed off on it, gave us permission. They never charged us anything to, you know, to use the name, to use the logo. Can you imagine?
Yeah, you'd be lawyered up today.
In this world today? Oh, yeah.
No. That'd be painful.
They welcome us. Every time we play Lansing, they bring an old Speedwagon out there.
And, wow.
You know, I've ridden around in them, so it's
very cool. Yeah, very cool. And I know, you know, your early days, you know, in the very early days, you were much bigger in some cities like Chicago and specifically St. Louis. You were playing like Busch Stadium one night. But then two nights later, you were playing in a bar in the middle of nowhere. It was kind of all over the board in the very beginning.
It was, but which was kind of cool because, you know, it gave bands a chance to make a name for themselves in locally and then build it from there. Whereas, you know, today's world, everything is pretty interconnected. So I would think it's a little more difficult for a young band to get a foothold now than it was back in those days. But hey, you know, it's the modern world, and you know, we all kind of hearken back to the days that you know when. You know, when we made it or when we did this or we did that. And, you know, the fact is, you know, it's today is today, man. You got to embrace what's going on. And I feel just so fortunate that we're still, people are still buying tickets to come and see
us of course.
Sing and play those songs. And we don't take ourselves seriously at all, but we do take what we do seriously. And we know that people are coming to see us and and they want to, they want to see something that's not just a bunch of guys resting on what they did in the past. We take the past and make it the present. And, you know, we are out there. Our thing is we want people to, we want to exceed people's expectations every night. And that's, that's, somehow we're still able to do it, man. We're still enjoying it, having fun, and
it's fun watching you. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. More with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. Kev, early on, the band didn't get much respect until you started touring with Aerosmith in the 1970s. There was a new level of respect, and it taught you how to give that respect to other bands for years to come.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we were the Midwest. We were the perfect opening act for the Midwest because we were really pretty popular, you know, in the heartland. And so when national touring acts would come to the Midwest, they'd pick up REO and we would be the special guests on the tour. Mm-hmm. But we were pretty popular. And so some of these bands would see that we were going over really well and they would basically sabotage us. You know, they'd mess with the sound, you know, turn the lights off on us and stuff. And it was kind of a drag, honestly. But
I don't think so.
But then we toured with Aerosmith, and I'll never forget the first show. Joe Perry walked in the dressing room, introduced himself. They welcomed us into have the after show meal with them and party with them and do the whole thing. And their thing was, I remember Steven Tyler told me that their thing was they wanted us to be as good as possible for the sake of the audience, but it also fired them up. That we would put the bar at a certain level, and they were so good that they weren't threatened by anybody, but it would inspire them to even play better. And I remember thinking, well, yeah, that's the right. That's
it makes
the
sense.
Right answer there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we always take the Aerosmith route rather than. Not to mention any names of the bands who sabotaged us, and I won't, but there were plenty of them.
So all of a sudden you have six albums under your belt. You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish, released in 1978, which, received so much FM radio airplay, 2 million copies, ultimately achieving double platinum status. Was that the album that you finally said, wow, you guys are really on your way?
Well, we felt pretty confident with the songs that we had written for that album, and so many of the albums that we made before that, we kind of felt like the record company would assign us a producer, but the producer never really kind of got what we did, and so the records would come out not sounding like us, it was really frustrating for a number of years, and so. That album, we went in and, Gary and I went into this meeting with the big wigs at Epic Records, and we demanded that either we're going to produce this record or we're not going to go in the studio. We thought we were big shots, right?
Yeah.
And then to our surprise, they were like, okay.
Oh, that's
and
great.
We
wow.
looked at each other and we were like,
did that just happen?
Well, what do we do? we're just a couple of rock musicians.
Yeah.
Sure enough, we kind of figured it out. So, you can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish was kind of the first record that we all kind of went, all right, yeah, this kind of sounds like us. So it was, and we had Roll with the Changes, Time for Me to Fly. We had some pretty strong material, so it kind of worked.
Oh, I remember Slow Dancing, A Time for Me to Fly at my 7th grade dance in 1979.
It was
a big night for me, Kevin. Big night.
Oh, really? All right. Well, good. That's the idea,
You broke into the mainstream again with High Infidelity. Sold more than 9 million copies. Keep on Loving You. Take It on the Run. Don't Let Them Go. There was a transformation of the band a bit to a little bit more popular music rather than harder rock. Was the band just evolving at the time, or was this more of a conscious effort to head in that direction?
No, we've never had any conscious efforts in the history of our band. Everything that we've done has pretty much been some sort of a happy accident, and the High Infidelity record was no exception. I literally, I'll never forget that. I kind of woke up in the middle of the night and wrote "Keep on Loving You," and you know, if you really pay attention to the lyrics. And verses of that song, it's not a real happy song.
No, and people play it like at weddings and stuff, and I'm thinking to myself sometimes, are you really listening? They were prom themes.
Did you listen to the lyrics to the B section of that first verse? But yeah, I mean, you know, but when I played that for the guys, it was like, you know, no, that's not an REO Speedwagon song. And finally, Rich Rath plugged in, you know, a Les Paul to a Marshall stack and got this nasty sound. And I think that his intention was basically to drown me out in the rehearsal hall. But I was like, dude, that's it. That's exactly what this song needed. And so, you know, that's kind of where the you know, we kind of stumbled into something, which is what we always, that's all we ever do. We just kind of stumble our way through, and some, you know, people kind of go, yeah, we dig that. And we're like, all right, cool, we'll do it again.
You know, so many bands hailed from Chicago, and you think about, you know, Styx and Cheap Trick, and I'm assuming they were most likely rivals back in the day, but not today. You guys are all kind of pretty close. You tour together, you've recorded some stuff together. Things are a little different today than they were back then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a, you know, it was a friendly competition, but, you know, it was a good competition. It was healthy, and it still is. I mean, we did a gig with Cheap Trick last weekend, and, you know, we were, you know, just really happy for those guys, man, that they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think...
Which you should be in there as well. I mean, I'm looking forward to that day too, man. Come on.
I don't know about that, but those guys for sure, you know, earned it, and they were so... you know, they're our buddies. I mean, you know, we love all those. And Styx, I mean, I just heard the other day, we've done over 300 shows with Styx.
That's amazing.
And and we're not done. You know, there's talk about, you know, going out with them again, you know, sometime soon. And I would love that. I love those guys.
Well, and a few years ago, you did a concert with them to raise money for the affected families of the tornadoes in central Illinois. And that's when Gary joined you guys for Riding the Storm Out. And I know that must have been so tough, because I know you had a great relationship over the years. You know, it must have been tough. I mean, he was a founding member. You knew him for a long time.
Yeah. No. It's still. I mean, his spirit is with us every night. I mean, every song that we play in our set, you know, Gary either wrote, you know, co-produced, played on the records. His stank is all over us. You know, and I've said it before, but it's so true that I learned everything I know about being in a rock band from Gary. I mean, when I joined the band, I was playing the Earl of Old Town in the quiet night in Chicago. You know, I was a folk singer, and you know, to this day, I pretty much channel Gary through. You know, I when I first joined the band, I just watched him, and I was like, okay, that's what rock stars are supposed to do, because Gary was. He was the real deal, you know, through and through. And
cool.
We miss him. We miss him every day. And you know, I'm thankful that I got to know him, and that I wouldn't be where I am today. Our band wouldn't be where we are today without Gary Rittrath, for sure.
And it's always a pleasure seeing you guys play. It's just, you guys are always rocking it out and sound just as great as you did 35 years ago, and always enjoy it. And Kev, I must have to say, it's time for me to fly. All right, actor Tony Danza started off as a boxer, but became a household name on 80s sitcom Taxi and Who's the Boss?
You're never going to believe who I just had as a fair.
Who?
Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yeah?
Neil Armstrong?
Imagine, the first guy who ever walked on the moon sitting in my cab.
Wow, I'm really impressed.
Hey, that's a great fad, Tony. Where'd you take him?
The unemployment office. Yeah, you know, they cut back on his space program. He's a little down on his luck. And it turns out he couldn't even pay the fare. Hey, which was lucky for me, because he gave me something even more valuable than money. A rock? This ain't no rock. This is a piece of the moon. He had a whole bag of them. What's the matter?
We're jealous.
Tony, did it ever occur to you that this guy that said he was Neil Armstrong might have been a phony?
Oh, Bobby, if he was a phony, where'd he get a piece of the moon?
Morning.
May I help you?
Well, if you're Angela Bauer, I'm here to help you.
I beg your pardon.
I'm Tony Maselli. I'm here about the job.
Oh, I'm sorry. There must be a mistake. This job is for a housekeeper.
That's me, Mr. Goodmop.
My mother's screening everyone. Did you meet her?
Yeah, yesterday. Yeah, you know, she gave me the once-over, kicked me the tires, put me up on a rack.
Well, she should have checked under your hood, because you're the wrong sex.
Oh.
How are you, Tony?
I couldn't be better, Dave. Thank you. That's quite a run there I've had.
That's quite a run.
40 years.
Of Taxi. Yeah.
That's wild. We all were together doing an interview recently, and I see a lot of them, and it's just the best group of people. It just really is.
I mean, countless Emmys, Golden Globe Awards, a legendary cast. I was just watching an episode this weekend. I mean, still to this day, you know how it is, like 40 years later, sometimes the comedy isn't that funny. There's nothing unfunny about Taxi, you know?
I'll take you another step. A couple of years ago, there was actually a Taxi marathon over one of the holidays, Labor Day or something. And I watched 19 shows.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not kidding. They were all great, and it amazed me. And what really was striking about it was that most of the shows, almost all the shows, were about this: somebody got in trouble, everybody came to his aid.
Yeah, that's right.
Even if it was Louie.
That's right. You know? Right.
It was just one of those great moments when everything sort of came together.
Classic series, and I know the year before even Taxi premiered, you were discovered like at a boxing gym by a TV producer and quickly landed that role as an ex-boxer on the show.
You know, Hollywood is sort of designed to give people breaks because they're cheaper and they're new and everything else. There's always that yearning for new, and so a lot of people get breaks, but not many people get that kind of a break.
Right.
Where you end up on a show like Taxi. And, the best part of it, too, Dave, for me was because I was so, I really had no experience. So it was sort of like going to school. And
sure.
and also another thing that always strikes me is that imagine these guys are knocking around, these actors. They've been working. They finally get this great show. It's got the great producers and writers from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. They won all the Emmys. This is going to be their next show. They got the best time slot on TV right after the number one show. They're on this ascendant network, ABC, And, oh, wait, there's one thing. We have this fighter that we found in New York. He's really never acted. Well, we're going to put him in the show. I wonder now how I would react.
Yeah,
The good news was they welcomed me, and I was able to, here I am.
And it's amazing to me. And after you did 4 or 5 seasons on Taxi and moved to NBC, after a year off, you get a role as a lead on another hit show, Who's the Boss, by the second season, another top 10 show out of the box.
Yeah, that was that's heady. That's pretty wild. I mean, that's pretty wild. Let me tell you, Who's the Boss? I'm so proud of that show because, and it's one of the things I like about this new show I'm doing. Is that, aside from the murder, it's a murder mystery, this new show. But aside from that, you could sit down with your family and watch this.
Absolutely. And
there's actually good themes in it. You know what I mean? It's an attempt to be funny and stuff. But I love that about Who's the Boss. I mean, we weren't, I'm proud of the show. And I don't think there's one moment you can't sit with your 6-year-old, your 14-year-old. Now, don't get me wrong, Mona, the euphemisms fly left and right. But for the most part, and we weren't proselytizing, but we were really, really careful about our message. what's that saying that Voltaire, somebody, you know, with great influence comes the responsibility.
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, when I was telling people, because your shows have touched different generations, like when I was telling folks, I had Tony Danza coming on the show this week, and we've got younger producers, and we've got management here that might be in their mid-30s, and one says to me, oh, man, Taxi, I think like Taxi's, you know, anniversary this year, and then the other one says, Taxi, no, he's from Who's the Boss? No, he's from Who's the Boss? And then this young producer says to me, well, he's in this new show with Josh Groban coming up on Netflix. So everyone's kind of touched your shows in some way, you know?
It's pretty good. Anyway, you know, I'm really, you know, it's unbelievable to be around as long as I have, because you really do get a perspective. That's it. Like, it's funny, is my recognition quotient right now, you know, if there is such a thing, is like, you know, about 27,
yeah.
28.
Yeah.
You know, like if I go into a restaurant, there's a young kid, there's a 22-year-old at the maitre d' stand, I could be in trouble. But if they're over 30, hey, I get the best table in the
That's great.
And remember, there's only two times you really want to be a celebrity. There's two times. And that is a restaurant and a hospital.
Oh.
Keep that in mind.
Never thought about that one. Yeah, I never thought about the second one. I like that. I like
a
that.
A table and a bed.
I like it. Thanks for hanging out with us, Tony, tonight. I appreciate it. Have a great time. Thanks again, pal.
Thanks very much for the time. Okay.
My pleasure.
Take care.
All right, Anthony Michael Hall has made an impression and an impact on many generations as we grew up with movies like National Lampoon's Vacation, 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, and countless other movies. He starred for 6 seasons in the USA Network's The Dead Zone. His recent work includes co-starring with Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween Kills, ABC's The Goldbergs, Netflix's War Machine with Brad Pitt, Live by Night with Ben Affleck, and to talk about his journey is Anthony Michael Hall. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Dave. Good to be with you today. Thank you for that great setup. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time. You know, the public probably sees you in your first memorable role as Rusty in Vacation, but you've been acting since you were 8. What got you started in the business? Like, what got you in the business at 8 years old?
You know what, Dave? It's actually kind of surreal. Here I am at this age, and I started 45 years ago at the tender age of 8, and I actually did a play with the late, great Steve Allen, another legend I had the privilege of working with as a young man.
Yeah,
and I was doing a play with him all those years ago, and that was my first job in 1976, and that was kind of a theater production that toured the summer stock circuit in the Northeast. So, yeah, you know, it's very surreal to me. I've been working, you know, for this many years, but I feel very privileged and very blessed that I've had, you know, a long career. And even as a young kid, that was always the goal, you know, to aim for longevity, to stay consistent and keep chipping away at it, as my father would say.
You played a young Steve Allen. By the way, Steve Allen was raised on the south side of Chicago here, and your first screen appearance was in a TV movie called The Gold Bug. You played Edgar Allan Poe. 82 was a first notable movie with Sixpack with Kenny Rogers and Diane Lane, but that big break came when you were Rusty in the original National Lampoon's Vacation, and John Hughes was a screenwriter. He wasn't directing, wasn't producing on that film, but you certainly caught his attention.
You do great research, sir. That's why you're you. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, John was, he was fantastic, and what happened was, you know, if fans of his work remember She's Having a Baby with Kevin Bacon, Elizabeth McGovern, that was one of the pictures he did in the 80s. You know, that was really John's story. So in that film, Kevin was playing John. He was an advertising guy that grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And he was writing copy, you know, for an advertising agency, and he started sending stories into National Lampoon magazine. So that's how his career began. So Vacation 58, as it was called, was an article, a piece that he'd written for Lampoon magazine, and it really took off. You know, it was kind of like on a whim that he decided to go for it and start sending in his own original written work when he wasn't writing ads during the day. And he had a great wife, his lovely wife, Nancy Hughes, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, as well. But so that's how we started. So it's a really interesting thing. We were sort of intertwined from the beginning, Dave, because, you know, it was my good fortune. I had a great opportunity to work with this great artist. And so I did not meet him on Vacation. And then after that, I auditioned for 16 Candles as a kid in New York City where I was raised. And then that led to Breakfast Club and Weird Science, which he just kind of handed to me. You know, so it was an incredible collaboration. And to be fair, it wasn't just me and me. I all the actors that he helped discover, he really created a great working environment. He was always collaborative. He was always encouraging, and he was just a great friend, and he loved to laugh. He loved music. You know, when we were here shooting those movies, he would pick me up on the weekends and Molly, and we'd go to record stores,
and
we'd go to blues bars, all kinds of stuff. He was just fantastic. You know, he was a great guy to work with.
Well, and plus you were working with Chevy, who was really at the pinnacle of his career. And, you know, and the cast was phenomenal. But Imogene Coca, like, I don't think there's a generation that really knows who she was as an actress early on in the first days of television. But, I mean, she That's made, right. you know, she made with your show shows, you know, that was the first variety show. It was, you know, call it an inspiration for what we see in Saturday Night Live and other improv shows today. But, you know, pretty cool that they That's chose her, point. Right?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Dave. And the truth is that was the original SNL, as you well know. I mean, it was before our time and era, but, you know, it was one of the first sort of live comedy shows, and she was just a wonderful lady to work with, really kind, and I loved working with her. And, of course, the great John Candy and, I mean, Bill Murray's brother, Brian Dole Murray, another group of, you know, another family of legends from the local area here in Chicago. So it was just such a privilege to work with all these people as a kid. I looked up to all of them. I learned from them all. And I just had such a blast, especially on vacation as well. It was a great experience because we actually made that trip. This is long before CGI and everything being digital. Right. So, yeah, just incredible opportunities I had as a kid. I'm really, really thankful for them.
Well, you were a young teen, too. So, you know, you were in a growing spurt. So what I've heard, what I've read, and you can tell me if this is fact or not, is that, you know, your various heights through this film, because it doesn't take 5 minutes to film something. And when you're a 14, 15-year-old kid, you know, you're going through puberty, so to speak, and you're growing, right. You know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because over the years I would joke with my parents and in retrospect, and I would tell them, you know what, it was like doing, you know, I call it the puberty on film trilogy, you know, the films I did with John. It was really funny, you know. And, you know, when it first all happened for me, it was really amazing. It was a bit daunting. It was scary. You know, you're suddenly being recognized everywhere, but I just felt so privileged, and I've always just, you know, counted my blessings, because it's really been a great career. I'm really fortunate to have worked with the people that we've discussed. And also, you know, it was a great, you know, foundation for me as a kid growing up as well.
I heard Hoover mention the fact that, you know, this was an R-rated film. This is only a couple of John Hughes films were ever rated R, but there was some nudity scenes in there, and you were a young kid, so you were quickly shuffled off the stage, weren't you?
My hormones are raging, as we all were at 14, right? So, yeah, there was a couple instances. It was actually the scene where we were doing that spoof of the Psycho
film. Yeah, the shower.
Beverly was, yeah, exactly. She was in the shower, and I'll let the audience go from there. But it was funny. I tried to sneak on the set there. I was a bad little boy, I guess.
That's awesome.
And then Maddie Simmons, our great producer. Yeah, I got the boot.
Yes, you did. More with Anthony Michael Hall on our radio special, Totally the 80s, after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Stay player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Anthony Michael Hall. Probably grew up with him in classic movies like The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. We just talked a little bit about John Hughes, and you were cast in what was his directorial debut, and that was 16 Candles. But he wrote that role just for you, didn't he?
You know what? I think he did. He kind of had me in mind after I'd done Vacation as a kid, and he really liked the work I'd done. And as we talked about earlier, you know, that was his first short story that he submitted to National Lampoon magazine. And then his career kind of took off. He wrote another classic with Michael Keaton, Mr. Mom, and some other films. And so 16 Candles represented the first opportunity where he was getting behind the lens and directing. And we shot the film right here in Chicago. We shot in Skokie and Evanston and all these great neighborhoods. And just great memories there. They really were, because it was such a relaxed environment on set. He really created a great tone, you know. And as leaders, you know, with respect to leadership, you always want to lead by example. And he was just a fun-loving, good-hearted guy. And he really cared about everybody he worked with and created a great working environment for us all to flourish. You know, he was awesome.
I love that. You did spend a lot of time here. I mean, because at Breakfast Club, same thing. And was that a different, you know, film for you, a little more grown up, maybe from a character perspective, a little more depth maybe than what you were doing earlier on?
Yeah, you're spot on with that, Dave. It was. And we had just finished the Breakfast, 16 Candles. And then John told me, he called me one day. I was back in New York City, you know, living with my parents in Manhattan. And I got a call and he told me about this project. And, you know, he just sort of gave me the role on the phone and I was flabbergasted. I mean, again, I'm just a kid at the time. And we went back to Chicago and we shot The Breakfast Club. It's interesting because I think it was based on a high school called New Trier here.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
I went to school, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
That's right.
So what we did is I think we shot it in Glenbrook North. It was a high school, I think, that had been shut down at the time in the 80s. And, of course, you know, guys of our age group will remember the USFL. At the time, the Chicago Blitz, they were also sharing that school. So it was the funniest thing. We built our sets inside the gymnasium. And then I'd see Vince Evans and the boys walking down the hallway, you know, going to, you know, practice on the field, you know, so we kind of shared it with the football team.
That's great.
And, you know, that library set that was built was constructed inside of that high school. and just a great experience. And, you know, and it's interesting because this situation kind of mirrors it. What Nick Sololci did and my other producing partners is we found this great university here, which is Elmhurst, and we've worked out a fantastic deal, and they've been really kind to welcome us, and we've been shooting at Elmhurst University here. So we're back to school again. That's how it goes, Dave.
I love that. I love that. I know, like, full circle, yeah, man, cool. And back in Chicago on top of it. I love it. Weird Science turns 35 this year.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
You know?
It's surreal.
Yeah, yeah.
Time flies, right?
It does. Yeah. It does.
That was the thing. We did those first two films here, and then on Weird Science, the deal that John had worked out with the studios, we started the picture here, and then we went back to L.A., and we filmed it, you know, all the interiors at Universal Studios on stage. So it was another great experience. And they were just three consecutive productions in a row. So over the course of, you know, 3 years, I had done these three films that
you have,
you know, live in the hearts of people, which is really awesome.
Well, you were offered Ferris Bueller, I believe, but, you know, did you just want to do something different and challenge yourself a bit more? Were you ready
I
for
did
something
at
else?
The time. Yeah. It was partly that, and it was also kind of entangled on another project. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. But, you know, that became a great hit for John, of course, and I, you know, of course, Matthew Broderick was fantastic in the film, and that was, as you know, shot here. So that was another great one. And then John was off to the races at that point. He had his own company and his own record label, and he just continued to do great work, with always the thread being the comedy, you know, characters that show their vulnerability, but somehow wind up a little better off than they started. So he was just, he really was brilliant. When I look back now, especially at this age, and I realize, you know, he was a young man still himself. He was only 35 to 38 doing all this great work, and just a great guy. You know, I miss him. I really do.
You were cast in a retool of SNL, youngest player ever at 17, and we're the same age, so I've followed you your entire career, but, you know, Robert Downey Jr., Dennis Miller, Lovitz, Nora Dunn, Joan Cusack, Damon Wayans, that must have just been a head spinner for you, because how cool is it to be a part of that SNL legacy?
Well, Dave, you're right on the mark again. That's a perfect description. It was a head spinner, because by the time that happened, as you know, typically the trajectory for people that do that show is they start out in comedy or Second City, the great organization here, or, you know, doing stand-up and such. So it usually works in reverse. You know, people work their butts off to get on that show or to be seen by, you know, the great Lorne Michaels who created it. And it kind of worked in reverse for me. I'd done these films, and I think that Lorne saw, you know, some talent in me in terms of doing the comedy and all that. And I just had a great time doing it, but it was absolutely a head spinner, because a lot of people don't realize that show. You know, you come in on a Monday, you start writing sketches, and as we know, like 30 Rock is based on that, but it's really that kind of environment where it's comedians, writers, it's just like, you know, it's like summer stock theater meets rock and roll meets everything all rolled into one. So by Thursday, you know, you're rehearsing the show around the clock for 2 days straight, even on Saturday, the third day of rehearsal, and then we tape the show twice, actually. We do it at 7:30 with one audience, and then they shuffle that audience out, and then we go live again. So it's really just a grind. It's an incredible amount of work each week that everybody does on that show. And as we know, over the years, now it's an institution. I mean, it's in its 40th season or whatever it is. Yeah. And there have been so many great men and women that have just been explosive on that show, who've gone on to great careers. Yeah, it's just fantastic.
No,
so it's a real tribute and a real honor, tribute to Lorne, and a real honor to have been a part of it.
But at such a young age, so much success, you know, how did you keep it all together?
It was difficult. You know, fortunately, I had great parents, and I was raised by a really tough, loving, you know, Irish, Italian, Catholic mom. And so I had that foundation, you know, of my faith, you know, and also great parents, and just keeping it real. They always did that with me. So, you know, a lot of the ideas of, you know, things that pertain to sort of like playing the celebrity card, all that stuff was really never of interest to me. I just enjoyed the work. And I always had that, you know, great family to go back to who taught me the right way, you know, and, I'm so grateful for that now. Of course, we don't see that till we're older, but of course, it was really so integral to my development.
It's awesome. You played a villain in Edward Scissorhands, challenging role in Six Degrees of Separation. You played Bill Gates in Pirates of Silicon Valley. So those roles truly started to pivot for you.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. Again, I mean, I went into that audition to play Gates. It was a TNT film, Turner Network. Yeah, same thing. Back in '99, and it was a great director named Martin Burke. And I remember kind of going into that audition, kind of method acting style. I had the glasses on, and I combed the hair, the side part like Mr. Gates has, and the whole thing. And great experience, you know. And the film went on to garner, I think, about 5 Emmy nominations. So it was a really, really interesting project for me, and I was very, very fortunate to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well,
Well, and you've done a ton of TV work as well. You know, The Dead Zone, you know, when you did The Goldbergs, and I loved, you've done more than one of them. I love showing my kids, because I've got kids in their teens and a little bit younger, and they have watched, you know, they will watch The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and everything, and I will find on my phone a picture of you then, or Vacation, and I'll be like, you see that guy right there? That's him right there. It's him right there.
Yeah, that's funny.
And how perfect on the 80s show. I mean, that's a great place to be.
It really was.
Anthony, this was great fun, and you are no stranger to Chicago. Enjoy your time here, and next time let's try to plan this in studio. Love to see you.
I'd love to see you too, Dave. Thanks. It's a real pleasure, and you're a gentleman. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. All right, take care.
Dave Pryor, WGN.
All right, welcome back to our radio special, Totally the 80s. Up next, Leah Thompson of 80s blockbuster Back to the Future.
So happy to talk to you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I can't believe we're close to the same age. So knowing this movie is turning 35, it just can't be, honestly.
I know. It's crazy. But you know what's exciting is people are still celebrating it and watching it. I guess it's on Netflix or something. So that's pretty exciting. I feel so lucky.
Well, you know, and you were playing Michael J. Fox's mom when you two were exactly the same age. And right? And all that makeup. Now, how old were you supposed to be when you had the makeup on you? Like, how old of a woman were you supposed to be?
It's so weird because everybody is making fun. I was supposed to be 47. You're so old.
Oh, my God. Well, let me tell you, at 47, I wouldn't even say how old you are now because we're the same age, but close to the same age, but you didn't get anywhere close to that. I mean, you look fabulous.
Well, thank you. But yeah, that was an interesting experience. And also, I've literally been playing the mother of a 17-year-old for 35 years. I think it's that. I don't think anyone else can say that.
No, probably not. No, probably not. You were in all the right moves, Red Dawn. You got that part in Back to the Future, and you credit your friend Eric Stoltz, who you starred in with The Wildlife. One of the producers saw you in that movie, right?
Yeah, they were both Universal Films, and The Wildlife was so, as far as I understand it. But you know, there's all these books about Back to the Future I've never read, and you know, so there's a lot of stuff I don't know or don't remember. But as far as I remember, they were watching it on what was called the Chem, which was this little thing that you could watch movies on as they were being cut, and they were looking at Eric, and they were like, "Who's that girl?" So. Yeah. That was nice, I think. But I did have to audition, and I remember it really vividly, my audition and my screen test. So it was a kind of a long process. And, you know, it's really fun to talk about it now. And we've done a lot of different Comic-Cons with Chris Lloyd and Michael and now lately Tom Wilson. And it's really fun to hear their perspectives on it and to kind of relive some of those moments and to see all the people. I mean, I always say, like, how many of you were born after this movie came out? And it's usually half the people at least. So
you talked about your audition. You know, it was in front of Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis, you know, right in front of you. Did that make you nervous? Because they were both kind of still fairly early in their careers.
Well, auditioning isn't a complete nightmare in any circumstance, but I do remember how nice Spielberg was, and he was actually operating the camera, which was really sweet. Wow. And I just remember, you know, sometimes you just, certain characters just click for you, and all the different iterations of Lorraine McFly, I understood them all. So sometimes you think you really know a character, and you get there and you start to do it, and you're like, wait a second, I'm not very good at this. But that one I was very good at. So for some reason, I just understood them.
Well,
and that's always a blessing.
Well, and you did some research, of course, for the role, like most actors do, but like what a 50s teenager was like. I mean, you really wanted, as an actress, you really wanted to nail that.
Yeah, well, it was a particular strange time because it was kind of after World War II, and there was all this interesting kind of propaganda about trying to get women out of the workplace and back in front of their stoves. So I read a lot of magazines and a lot, I listened to music. I listened to Mr. Sandman all the time.
Oh,
in order to get into character because it's such a goofy song. And then I was super happy that I guess because he heard it so much when we were shooting that Bob Zemeckis actually put Mr. Sandman
in the movie, right? Yeah, that's great.
But that song is so ridiculous that it would get me into the mood because I was weirdly not that person.
So there was a scene in this movie that's so well known, probably the most poignant, was when your character kissed Marty McFly and realized something was terribly familiar or terribly wrong. And that was a big shift. I mean, that was a big shift in the movie and so well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that you noticed that. There were two things like that where the acting had to completely change the plot. And I remember that Bob Zemeckis was really nervous, especially about that moment, because I had to go so full steam ahead with, you know, trying to seduce him into falling in love with me and all of that. And then that one moment I had to change everything. And and then there's the other moment where after the Crispin hits Biff and he falls down and I have to fall in love with him, right? Just looking up at him. Now, they gave me the most beautiful light and the most beautiful, music cue, but still, we had to sell that. And so that's one of those things that's really fun for an actor when they really depend upon you to help, pivot the stories. There's also, I think, a very, 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 very deep message in that film is that, having the courage to stand up for something you believe in at the right moment in your life can change everything. And I think that's something that we as parents want to instill in our children, to have the courage to stand up for themselves or the people that they love, and not back down at that most important moment of your life.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, that's definitely the truth. And that's it's a very powerful message. Also, that your parents are people too, and time travel is such an interesting thing. Right now I'm watching Outlander because that's a time travel kind of show. It took me a while to watch it, but my husband and I, and it's always so poignant to go back in time and see things the way they were.
Yeah. Well, and then that gave you such a range, too, because obviously you were playing someone, a kid in the 1950s, not that far off for how old you were when you were doing the movie, but then, playing the parent and all that makeup, by the way, that you had to do. I have to imagine that took hours to put you in makeup for that.
Yeah, that makeup was hard. It's actually very hard to make someone like 47.
Yeah.
I was just noticing, again, in Outlander, they didn't even bother to make her up to try to, because you're not that old.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It was a lot easier to make me, whatever they made me, 87 or something in Back to the Future 2.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's a lot easier than kind of just making someone a little older. They made me a little heavier, but so that was easier. But yeah, that makeup is very painful. It's also very scary because I remember, do you remember the scene where I bring out the cake in the beginning and I go... Yeah, your Uncle Joey didn't make parole again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the makeup is joined on your face with this glue, and if you break it, it can't be fixed. So we were having a very long day, and we were doing that scene, and Crispin Glover was so funny with his greasy hair and his weird laugh, where he's like, ho, 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 ho. He was doing that weird snake laugh that he did, and I was trying so hard not to laugh and break my makeup because they would have had to wrap and it would have screwed up the day. So that was a kind of a fun memory that I had, like just trying to laugh without moving my mouth. Like, it's really hard.
But I mean,
because no one could keep a straight face. He was so good and so funny.
Well, again, on this day, the Back to the Future celebrating 35 years old, I'm so glad that you joined me to do some reminiscing. It's just such a fun film and great for the whole family. And I'm thrilled that you're still engaged talking about it all. I appreciate your time today, Leah.
Thank you. It's good to be 35 again.
There we go. Always a pleasure.
All the very best. Thank you so much for having me.
One of the biggest hits on TV toward the end of the decade was The Wonder Years. For six seasons, this 80s comedy captured the angst in growing up in suburban middle-class America in the 1960s, as seen through the life and times of Kevin Arnold. It won an Emmy, a Peabody, and a Golden Globe for Best Series and starred Chicago's very own Fred Savage.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do
you like? Fred, how are you, pal?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and particularly a pleasure to talk to WGN. It's always great to talk to you guys.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, you're talking about growing up in Glencoe, so you spent a good chunk of your early life here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I lived on Park Avenue in Glencoe and grew up in the same house my dad grew up in.
Oh, that's cool.
Until I was about, probably 13 or 14 years old.
So when you were doing movies and television in the early years, you were just out there for the season, and you would come back here, and this was still home for you.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I would go, you know, to location or to L.A. or to Vancouver or to wherever the work was, wherever the job was, and then I would always come back home to Glencoe.
So what took you out to California? What at what point in your life did you say, did your folks say, hey, you know, this kid's talented? Or did you say, hey, you know, I really want to do this? How did you make it out to California to try your way in acting?
Well, I started acting when I was in Chicago. I mean, I started doing, commercials downtown. And, I did a whole bunch of movies when I was young, when I was still living in Chicago. So, you know, I moved out to Los Angeles once the Wonder Years started. You know, we shot the pilot of the Wonder Years. I came back to L.A., and then our first season was short. Our first season was 6 episodes. And I came, to L.A. for that, and then I went back. And then as my family as my parents really started to realize it was going to be a longer-term commitment, we started to slowly relocate out here. But it wasn't until the Wonder Years was kind of up and running that we relocated.
Now, you were mentioning you did a bunch of television shows. You did like a reboot of The Twilight Zone. You did Crime Story. I remember you on Crime Story. But the first big film you did was The Princess Bride, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did one movie before that when I was really young, when I was about 8 years old, called The Boy Who Could Fly.
Oh, right.
And then Princess Bride was the movie I did right after that one.
Okay. Now, I know you did a movie with Judge Reinhold called Vice Versa.
We actually shot in Chicago.
And you shot it here.
Yeah.
I remember The Princess Bride, too, had all kinds of your bedroom, had all kinds of Chicago stuff around it. So Chicago has kind of followed you.
Yes, no, it has. And that was actually because I wish I could say that was my doing. I mean, I loved it. But, you know, William Goldman, who wrote the book that the movie was based on, is a Chicago guy. And so all of those Chicago elements that were on the set were in the original book.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, this Vice Versa, that's how you got a casting director saw you in Vice Versa, and that's kind of how you got the Wonder Years gig?
Yes, that's exactly how that came about. Okay. I'd done this film called Vice Versa, and actually the creators of the Wonder Years, a couple in a writing team named Carol Black and Neil Marlins, they saw that movie and had their casting directors contact us and say, oh, you know, hey, we thought you'd be, you know, think you'd be great for the show.
That's awesome. You know, I'm a little bit older than you, but I grew up in the late 70s watching Happy Days and stuff. And this Wonder Years was really the next generation of those shows. It was really a look back at a fonder, simpler time of life. It was so well done, so well written, so well put together. It was really one of the first single camera comedies that are out there, which are so common now.
It was definitely it certainly wasn't the first by any stretch, but at that time there weren't many out there, and so it was kind of a unique way visually to tell the story, and I think really helped embrace and encapsulate kind of the nostalgia of that era.
You really grew up on this show. What do you remember about the early days? Because you were pretty young.
I have nothing but positive memories of doing that show. You know, I remember it was very sad leaving my friends. You know, I was hard to leave Chicago, but I had just a great time. I loved being in L.A. I loved working on the show. It was just nothing but kind of positive memories.
There was something I read, and you say that, and you said it was just a great set. People respected that there were kids on the set, which is so incredibly important. But I read an interview in Esquire where you talked about an episode where the folks had a party and the adults were playing Twister. And you got a little more than you were bargained for there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, look, we did, you know, we worked on that show for 6 years. Or maybe a little bit more even, and did, you know, I don't know, over 100 episodes. So, I mean, anytime you get that many people working together for that many years, there's, you know, things are bound to happen. But
sure.
It was definitely a really positive, really friendly set and a great place to grow up.
Yeah. And, you know, I would assume could have been your first kiss on air in life, too, with Dan.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true.
I would think so with Danica McKellar, who's just lovely. Any favorite episodes from back then that you fondly look on and say, gosh, that was a fun show to do? Like, do you ever see the shows? Do you ever watch them with your kids?
You know, my kids just started watching the episodes, actually, with my mom started showing them to them recently, like in the last few weeks. So yeah. That's been a new thing. And to see them enjoy it and to see them talk about it as much as they are and really react to it and respond to it, seeing this next generation really embrace the show has been thrilling for me. And you know, particularly being my own kids, it's even more exciting.
Well, some of the shows that are on for young people, I got two young kids. I have three young kids, actually, but one's really young, that watch some of the Disney Channel and Nickelodeon stuff. And, you know, not all of it is great quality. So I like it when they throw on a classic program, whether it's from the 70s or the 80s that, you know, and this one's pretty timeless because it takes place in a certain era. It takes place in the 1960s. So it really never gets old because when you're watching it. But the kids always relate to those situations of getting the girl and dealing with a difficult teacher or dad's coming home, which would be me, a little irritable tonight. But it's just one of those shows that I think everyone's got some kind of connection to, no matter what area you grew up in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that made the show so great then and so timeless is that it really does kind of address universal questions, problems, moments in adolescence that we've all experienced, whether you grew up, you know, in the 60s or the 90s or today or whether you grew up in the United States or across the world, that people have really responded to it because I think there are those kind of transcendent moments in growing up that everyone can relate to and experience.
And that was Chicago's own Fred Savage. A reboot of The Wonder Years, by the way, airs this fall on ABC. As we wrap up our radio special, Totally the 80s, George Wendt from Cheers is coming up next. Here is my conversation with Chicago's own George Wendt, Norm, from 80s TV classic Cheers.
Afternoon, everybody.
Norman?
Hey, what's happening, Norm?
It's a dog-eat-dog world, Sammy, and I'm wearing milk-bone underwear. Afternoon, everybody.
Hey, Mr. Peterson, Jack Frost nipping at your nose?
Yeah, now let's get Joe Beer nipping at my liver, huh?
Sometimes you wanna go where everybody knows your name.
You know, I knew you were part of the famed Second City, George, but I did not know that you were actually born here. You were born in Beverly.
Yeah.
So you spent a lot of years, was it your grammar school years here?
Little Company of Mary Hospital on 95th in California. And right across from Rosangela's Pizza.
Oh, very nice.
went to, you know, Christ the King School in Beverly. And then went off to a boarding school for high school.
Wow, up north, right?
That was weird, yeah. Not very far north, just Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Jesuit boarding school called Campion. And it was open for 100 years and closed not too long after I went there. And now it's a prison.
Oh, no.
And if that's not poetry, I don't know what is.
Oh, my. I would say so. And then you went to Notre Dame University. How did that go?
Well, I was a legacy. My dad was an alumnus of Notre Dame, class of 43. And I got in much like I imagine George Bush got into Yale as a legacy. I was a mediocre student.
Yeah.
Tested well. And I had the time of my life at Notre Dame, which wasn't easy back then, but it was so, compared to Campion, it was like Sodom and Gomorrah.
I bet.
I did nothing but party and partied my way right out of school. It was the middle of my junior year. I got a 0.00. And but I'd like to tell people, so I was asked to not return.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But I'd like to tell people that that the real story was that Coach Parsegian called me into his office and said that I'd pretty much taken sitting on a bar stool and drinking about as far as I could on an amateur basis, and that it was time for me to go to the pros.
Oh, nice.
And, I promised my dad, though, that I would, you know, get my degree. So I've reapplied to Notre Dame every year since. And apparently, I am no longer Notre Dame material.
It's over.
Yeah.
It's over.
So well, I took my degree from Rockhurst College in Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, as I say, you got your degree in economics. How did you find your way into acting?
Yeah, well, I was really just a clueless, aimless young man. I think the charitable way to put it is it would be late bloomer.
Okay.
And but after I got out of college, I was getting a lot of what are you going to do with your life, and I had no idea. So this friend of mine said, "Oh, if you don't know what you want to do, I know what you do." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You go to Europe."
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for my dad and some other odd jobs. And got some money together and went over to Europe with a backpack and a hitchhiking thumb and wound up staying, off and on the better part of 2 years.
Wow.
Living on the side of the road, kind of thing. And thing you can only do when you're like 23 or 24.
Sure.
And then I, after 2 years of that, I signed up for Second City Workshops.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, you made it back to Chicago, and I have to ask you, obviously, the audition process must have been pretty interesting because, you're working with a lot of simplicity when it comes to Second City.
Yeah, it was my first audition for Second City. I'd gotten jumped in a bar outside of Sox Park with, I went to a Sox game with some friends, and we thought in our wisdom, we thought we'd go in this bar at 33rd and Wallace to let traffic die down. And some of the local youngsters didn't enjoy our presence in their turf or something. I don't know. Anyway, we got jumped, and so I went in my Second City audition with a big black eye and a cut over my ear. That didn't work too well.
And the rest of your class, you were working with Kazurinsky and Miriam Flynn and Del Close and Danny Breen, Mary Gross. That's it's a nice group.
And I'm working with Kazurinsky again in the fall. We're doing a new play, a world premiere at North Light.
Oh, cool. Oh, cool. Yeah, you guys work together quite a bit. Now, I remember seeing you very briefly, like in an episode of MASH and an episode of Taxi, but then all of a sudden, boom, you got the role on Cheers. How did that all come about?
Fairly normal way. Agent called and said, "See, I was on this other show called Making the Grade,
mm-hmm.
And I was a series regular on that. But we only shot six, and that was it. But the fate of Making the Grade hadn't been determined. So my agent said, honey, they want you to do this show, Cheers." A very small role, but you like those guys. Remember, you did Taxi with them, and so I think you should do them a favor and show up. So I said, sure. So I went, and there was one line, actually one word, one syllable. Can you guess?
Just Norm.
No, beer.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was meant to play Shelley's first customer in the tag after she'd been hired on.
Okay.
And she would go, "Diane, hi, I'm Diane. I'll be your waitress. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm not really a waitress. I'm an academic." And on she went, as she did, you know. And she said, oh, I should probably take your order. What can I get you? And I go, beer.
Beer. It should have been beer, of course.
Beer, perfect. And that was the end of the episode. And they said, oh, that's too small. You know, we can't really audition you with just the one syllable. Why don't you read this other role? So I did, and it was a character named George. And it was the Norm guy, right? And so I read that, and then they tried to make it work where I could do both shows. And even though they were both Paramount shows, Paramount was cool with it, but the CBS was not cool with it. So I just did Cheers pilot as a guest star.
Interesting.
And then my show on CBS got canceled, and Cheers worked out. Got the offer for that.
One of the greatest TV shows of all time, 11 years. You appear in just about every one of the 275 episodes. It really defined the phrase must-watch TV. And you must look back at those years with a wow. Ted, you know, Woody, Shelley, Kirstie, you know, John, once in a lifetime.
Ebi, Kelsey.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Absolutely. I'm assuming people still want to buy you a beer when they see you, though.
That happens.
And that was George Wendt of TV classic Cheers. That wraps up our radio special, Totally the 80s, and thank you for joining us. Top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom are next here on 720 WGN.